Continuing with Chapter 6 of Canto 2, Purusha Sukta confirmed. Yesterday we covered a group of verses where Brahma was stating for a second time in the chapter the answer to one of Narada's questions, that question he was answering was, where does everything come from? What is the absolute truth? Are you not the source of everything that exists? And so Brahma answers that question, and he kind of over-answers the question. He answers additional things. Like, since those ingredients that come from the Supreme Personality of Godhead have a purpose, the purpose is sacrifice, and so I manifested them from the limbs of the body of the Lord for the purpose of sacrifice. And those of you that like to study Bhagavad Gita, you certainly can remember in Chapter 3 of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna stating the same thing. This is from Brahma's perspective. Krishna states it from his perspective. In the beginning of creation, I sent forth generations of men and demigods, and with them this sacrifice. Because by the process of sacrifice, one can render all those things created sacred, or again connected, acknowledge the connection with the Personality of God. That's what the purpose of sacrifice is, and that's what the purpose of creation is sacrifice. So take those things, it's an opportunity to take those things which come from God and offer them unto Him. So he's stating answer to two questions. Where does everything come from? And what's the purpose of those things? The purpose is sacrifice. So we're going to cover this morning text 29. Through 32. Brahma is still speaking. He's going to answer a couple more questions, because at the beginning of this discussion, Narada had a whole lot of questions. Narada is the son asking his father, what's it all about? How does it work? Who is the Supreme? Where does everything come from? What's the purpose of those things that have come into being? How is everything maintained once it's set up? He wants to know that also. Maintenance. I'll just give you a sneak preview. What these verses are going to focus on is Brahma's disclosing. He's the topmost authority, and he's disclosing that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the maintainer of everything, and there is no one above him. There's no one equal to or greater than him. I am subordinate to him. Lord Shiva is subordinate to him. He is the Supreme. And we do things under his direction. We do important things, but it's only from him and under his direction. We're the servants, Ekala Ishwara Krishna Arasava Britya. Everyone, there's one Eka Ishwara, and everyone else is his servants. So that's he is the one who, once everything is set up, he maintains it. He does that directly. I do the creating, Shiva does the destroying under his authority. We are sustained by his energy, and he is independent and he maintains everything. That's the theme of this section. So, Brahma continues, text 29. My dear son, thereafter, that's after the items of sacrifice have been generated from the limbs of the Lord by Lord Brahma, your nine brothers, who are the masters of all living creatures, performed the sacrifice with proper rituals to satisfy both the manifested and non-manifested personalities. So the nine brothers refer to the nine principles, rishis. There's different numbers, the Sapta rishis and the Dava rishis. So in this case, it's the nine brothers of Narada. That means they're direct sons of Brahma. And they're listed as Marichi, Atri, Angira, Pulascha. Those are all familiar names. Bhrigu, Atharva, Kratu, and Pulaha. So those are the nine brothers that he's referring to in the verse. Nine rishis. They're one of their functions, besides knowing the Vedas, is to perform the activities described in the Vedas. And one of the principal activities described in the Vedas is the process of sacrifice, the karmakanda rituals. And it's been described just in our group of verses yesterday. Those karmakanda rituals invoke the names of various devas, various demigods. Ultimately, the purpose of that invoking of the names of the devas is to qualify one further in goodness and eventually bring one to the shelter of Lord Vishnu. That was stated. Yagyavai Vishnu, Moktaram Dhyakitapasam. That verse was quoted. In all the karmakanda rituals, at the very, very, very beginning, the first mantra recited is invoking the personality of Godhead as the bhokta of the yajna. Sometimes even directly, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. And then the whole rest is something else. It's to bring people to the lotus feet of Vasudev, or Krishna, or Vishnu, when that's not really where they want to be. They want to be enjoyers of material facilities. But they have to acknowledge the enjoyer of the sacrifice, the beneficiary of the sacrifice, for a proper Vedic sacrifice to be conducted. So the nine great sages who are the brothers of Narada, that's one of the principal functions that they would perform. And so they did. And when they did so, the rituals that they performed were invoking, acknowledging both the manifested and the non-manifested personalities. So in the purport is explained, the manifested personalities meant the demigods. And the non-manifested personalities indicates the personality of Godhead. And Prabhupada explains in the purport that during Vedic times, when the demigods were propitiated, they would show up and accept the sacrifice, the offerings and the sacrifice, and go back to their abode. And that doesn't happen these days. Prabhupada says, in the age of Kali, The manifested demigods are also not to be seen, for space travel has completely stopped. That means this kind of space travel. They have no reason to come and participate in functions with gross personalities that don't have the qualifications. But when there's qualifications, when qualified brahmanas would perform and qualified persons participating, they would come. Sometimes. So now they're in the category of also not seen or not manifested. And the Supreme Personality of Godhead is also not manifested. And so in the times when people say, show me and I'll believe, then they don't hold faith in the demigods or God, and so they go on with a whole other way of life, a godless way of life. Sacrifice has stopped. And the fruits of sacrifice are also stopped. People are losing their piety, and the bounty of nature is, compared to Vedic times, shrinking. And so people have this worry about scarcity and overpopulation and all these other godless things. This is another, like a little bit more distant theme that's being presented, but the theme that's, it's a frontal attack on modern mechanistic science, because modern mechanistic science does not wish to look at any cause other than the observable immediate cause. You know, the push and pull, the cause and effect of the laws of nature. That's all there is. That's the only thing that's measurable. And so that's all there is, as far as modern science is concerned. So then, that goes into the very next verse. One of Narada's questions is, where does everything come from? And then another question is, how is everything maintained? So the next verse directly says, the Lord personally maintains everything. Here's the verse. All the material manifestations of the universes are therefore situated in His powerful material energies, which He accepts self-sufficiently, although He is eternally without affinity for the material modes. Prabhupada writes in the purport, the question put by Narada before Brahma concerning the sustenance of the material creation is thus answered. Material actions and reactions, that's what modern science is, study of that. As the material scientist can superficially observe, are not basically ultimate truth in regard to creation, maintenance, and destruction. So one can get a clue about where everything comes from if one can understand how everything is maintained. And material science says the maintenance is only the laws of nature. What's the ultimate truth? The ultimate truth is there's matter and there's laws of matter, and that's the ultimate truth. Where does matter come from? It doesn't come from anything, it just is. That's God. You want to say, where does nature come from? You say it's God. We say it just is, then that's God. That's where everything comes from. There's matter and laws of matter, that's all there is. And it becomes manifest when there's a big bang. and it becomes unmanifest when the laws of nature implode matter back into itself and it goes back into this non-existent state or unmanifest state or falls into a black hole or something. Just a little detour, but one program at the University of Houston was with the Indian Graduate Student Association. So it was all graduate students, all a room full of about 60 master's and PhD students in different fields. And I had just made a presentation on Mysteries of the Sacred Universe. It was questions and answers session. And one of the students raised his hand and said, this is very interesting because it seems that it's not in contradiction with modern scientific theory having to do with Big Bang cosmology. So he went into describing, according to modern science, mathematically up to a few milliseconds before the Big Bang happened, mathematically they can calculate exactly what was the condition of the universe. Okay. And then from that explosion, the universe expanded. And then that's where there's divergence in modern theory. One theory says that by the laws of gravity, mass attracting other mass and causing gravitational field, there's a certain point at which the expansion of the universe is going to reach a point where it then just falls apart and dissipates into nothingness. And then there's another theory that one Harvard professor, now expired professor, says that he likes the Vedic model because the Vedic model says that after that time is cyclical and after a certain point of time when that gravity can no longer hold the universe in its position, it will then implode upon itself and come back again to a resting state. So he likes that idea. And his point was, there's different views in modern science about how the Big Bang happens and what happens after that, but it's not inconsistent with the Vedic model. That was my concluding point. And my comment was, and then there was another person that had some counter argument to make. No, it's not exactly like that. And I said, whichever model you go with, the model that these fellows are speaking about says that in the beginning there was nothing, and in the end there's nothing. So where does that put us now? It's nothing. From nothingness to nothingness, and what's going on now? Nothingness. That's not a very warm idea, inviting idea. But the Vedic model also describes the expanding universe and the imploding universe, but the Vedic model says, in the beginning there's a person. Much more warm. And in the end there's person, and in between there's person. And if you want to know how it works, you have to go to more subtle means than just observing the push and pull of material creation. As yesterday's discussion said, the whole of the Vedic process is dependent upon sound vibration very subtly and very scientifically being vibrated. Then one can make this connection through sacrifice with the Supreme. And the purpose of making that sacrifice in connection with the Supreme is not just, it's not just to become peaceful and to get free from the bondage of karma, and those things may also happen, but it's to make the connection with the Supreme, because that's the real mission of human life. So the modern scientist, he's got his point of view and poses himself as an authority. And we can take a look at those modern scientists and see what value they're adding to the world and what the quality of their life is and what their character is. And then we can look at Lord Brahma, see what value he's adding, and you know, the authoritative position from which he is speaking. He's got first-hand knowledge. He did it. And he knows. And what smart capacity does Brahma have compared to the material scientists? Let them build the universe. Go ahead. Challenge you. With all the intricacies and how smart Brahma is. And he's disclosing the both, here in this verse it's the maintenance. The Lord is directly maintaining. He's maintaining through his energies. He's not running around with a wrench and a pair of pliers. The maintenance guy. He's maintaining through his energies. Directly. And that's what the next verse says. 32. By his will, I create. Lord Shiva destroys. And he himself, in his eternal form as the personality of Godhead, maintains everything. Prabhupada gives the example in the previous purport. He says that a big wealthy man, through his influence and money and position, he can build buildings and destroy buildings. But when he's occupying the building, he personally sees to the maintenance. It's not like, again, he runs around with a wrench and a pair of pliers. But he's directly involved with it. Whereas somebody else, he makes a plan and, you know, he's off on the golf course where somebody's building his house or his factory or whatever it is. And when he buys something, he doesn't go out there and smash it down and, you know, put something else up. He has somebody else do it. It's through the agency of his energies. So the agent of Brahma as the creator and the agent of Shiva as the destroyer, Brahma is saying, we are deriving our capacity to do those things from him. And he personally sees to the maintenance. So, the verse of text 31 says that in his, everything is situated in his powerful material energies. So the energy of creation, the energy of maintenance, the energy of destruction, these are material energies. Srishti, Stiti, Pralaya. And he has his agents. Durga is one of his agents, Shiva is one of his agents, Brahma is one of his agents. And they're all operating through his powerful energies, material energies. And so this is the topic of Purusha Sukta confirmed. It's what's the relationship between the energetic and the energy? What's the relationship between the spiritual source of everything and this manifestation? That's the topic. Well, material science has a very different perspective. Just say it again, it's kind of obvious. But they don't accept the authority of this spiritual sound vibration, the authority of the scripture. They accept only what they can see and measure. A more honest, an honest position of a material scientist is to say, we don't know. I had that experience with one scientist, very, very briefly. When I was in high school, as a senior in high school, our school, the high school that I went to, had took part in the American Field Service, AFS. It's a foreign student exchange, and students would come from some other country and stay with some family in your school, and you would send somebody to some other school in some other country in their senior year of school. So my parents invited, they became the host during my senior year of someone that came from Japan. His name was Ken, he still is, Ken Ijiri. So Ken stayed in our home. And he was a brilliant student. I mean, and after we both graduated, he went on to earn his triple PhD. His first PhD at the University of Tokyo was in mathematics. Second PhD was in physics. And his third PhD at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor was in molecular biology. And what he studied for 3 years in University of Michigan in Ann Arbor was the, with his skills of math, physics, and molecular biology, how a cell of a frog divides into two cells. That was his PhD. Physics, mathematics, and molecular biology. How a cell divides into two. So after he finished his third PhD, and he came to visit me. I hadn't seen him for however many years it was, since I became a devotee and he went on for his three PhDs. He came to visit me in New York on his way back to Japan. And we had a little nice discussion about what his life's work was. And I asked him a question. He said, just supposing that an essential component in why and how a cell of a frog splits from one into two has something to do with introducing a spiritual component like a soul or Paramatma or something like that. And he gave a very quick answer and said, as a scientist, we couldn't even talk about that because it's not something measurable. We can't say, we can't even make a comment about it. It may be, it may not be. That's not our field. Our field is things that are measurable. I said, that's an honest answer. But there are lots of persons that would say, hogwash, rubbish, not possible. All there is matter and laws of matter. So they're like committed atheists. And this is an agnostic. I don't know. Who knows? We can't measure it, so we can't say. So that's a more honest answer. But there in the world today, I've forgotten all their names now, but there's this big wave of scientists pushing the agenda of God is rubbish. I forget the author's name, some guy from Oxford University, writing a big-selling book that says that God is a myth. I think that's the title of the book, something like that, from a scientific point of view. And, you know, there's lots of people waving flags saying, yeah, at last you've come out and said it. God's a myth. Because all there is matter and the laws that govern matter, and that can explain everything. And it certainly can explain certain things. But what we're getting from the Bhagavatam is that those are material laws, yes, of cause and effect, yes. And where do those laws come from? And where does the matter come from? That's Narada's question. And Brahma's answer is it comes from the unmanifest state of the limbs of the body of the Supreme Lord. And then those things become manifest, and yajna happens, and then auspiciousness happens because of the yajna. And then when yajna stops, then all you, it seems there's no access to understanding the Supreme. So they're very opposing worldviews, the theistic and the atheistic view. Very much in opposition. There are some points where there's overlap. There's certainly laws of nature. There's matter and there's laws that govern matter, and those things are real. That's a causal component to existence. But there's a remote cause that's not measurable. by molecular biologists and scientists. But it is accessible through sound vibration, through this descending method. And one can directly experience it. And that's what Prabhupada says. Even in these days, God can be seen by qualified eyes tinged with the ointment of love of God. So, if one wants to see God, they should see through the pages of authentic scriptures and should not simply believe in their unqualified eyes. So we have this tug of war going on for the minds of living entities in this world. The atheists are tugging in one direction and theists are tugging in another direction. The atheists are winning, at least apparently, in numbers, because the minds of so many persons have gone in that direction. What the Bhagavatam would like us to understand is from the authority of Narada, the whole of creation is resting in the energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And in that sense, the Lord is within everything, because everything is within His energy. That's the statement in the purport here. The Lord is not required to do anything personally, but everything in the material world is carried out by His wishes and direction. Parasya Shaktir Viva Daiva Shoyate Sorbhavaki Gyanam Bala Kriyacha. By His willing, things happen. And they happen through the agency of His energies. He doesn't even have to say, could you move this over there? He doesn't have to even say it. He just desires for it to happen, and it happens through the agency of His potencies. Therefore, the entire material manifestation is situated in Narayana, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And there's many Vedic statements that skip describing the detail of the unfolding of the elements and so on, but simply make those statements. This is in Narayan, that's in Narayan, this is in Narayan. Or in the first canto of the Bhagavatam, Vasudeva is everything. From Bhagavad Gita. Bahunam janmanam ante jnanavan mam prapajate. Vasudev Sarvamiti Samahatma Sadurlava. There it is. Vasudev is everything. Vasudev Parama Kaha, Vasudev Paro Vedo, Vasudev Param Jnanam. Vasudev is everything. That's the conclusion of the Vedas. So then you get that idea going, and then you get some persons think, yeah, impersonalism. All there is Vasudeva, you know, the floor is Vasudeva, and the air is Vasudeva, and I'm Vasudeva, and you're Vasudeva, and everything's Vasudeva. How do you call it? It's all one. So then, no, you have to go another step. There's, and the energy and the energetic. Oh. If you have the energy and the energetic, then you have two. It's all one. Everything is positive. So that's where this, it's a more subtle and personal conception that the energy and the energetic have their oneness, but they also, they're distinct. One's energy, the other's energetic. Not that everything comes from the energy, everything comes from the energetic. And there are varieties of energy. That's a more complete understanding. Prabhupada writes in the purport. This is our last purport. The conception of one without a second is clearly confirmed here. So, Prabhupada liked to speak about the absolute truth as one without a second. In the verse books, there's one phrase, asamurdva, that Prabhupada would use again and again. Sama means equal, and urdva means greater. And you put the prefix a in front of it, it says, he is one who has no equal, asama, and there is no one greater than him. A urdva, asamurdva. He who has no equal, and there's no one greater. So there's a category called Vishnu Tattva. And there's, in that category of Vishnu Tattva, there's one. There's different names and different forms, but it's one entity. Like living entities, there's so many living entities in that category, so in material Prakriti, so many categories of Prakriti. Internal energy, so many categories of internal energy. And the category of the Supreme is a category where there's one member. And there's no one equal to or greater than him. And Prabhupada is disclosing in the purport. That's what Brahma is sharing with us or disclosing. The absolute truth is one without a second. There's no one equal to, no one greater than him. Brahma the creator, the speaker, first person singular, by his will, I create. By his will, Shiva destroys. By his own direct arrangement, everything is maintained. He is the powerful controller of these three energies. There's no one greater to or equal to him. And in the purport, Prabhupada gives so many scriptural references that says the same thing. Matak parataram nanya Bhagavad Gita. There's no truth superior to me. Kinchid asti dananjaya. Mayi sarvam idam protam sutrani mamikananava. Everything is resting upon me as pearls are strung on a thread. It is said in the Vedas, Vasudeva paro brahman nachanyorto sti tatvataha. In fact, there is no greater truth than Vasudev. So, many such Vedic statements. There's one supreme. The Vedic conception of absolute truth, we know this from Vedanta Sutra, the absolute truth is da-da-da-da, that from which everything else comes. That's what the absolute truth is. And that from which everything else comes does not have a source. Like, you know, the rhetorical question, if God creates everything, where does God come from? And it's literally a rhetorical question. By definition, God, or the absolute truth, is that from which everything else comes. Okay, very good. Where does that come from? By definition, the absolute truth has no other source. The absolute truth is that from which everything else comes. And that's what this matak paratram nanyat means. There's no truth superior to me. Truth has this existential idea that something is resting upon it. You know, foundation, like the house is resting on the foundation. So we can say, okay, what's the foundation resting on? What's resting on the earth? Okay, what's the earth resting on? Well, it's resting on the gravitational field of matter. Okay, there we go. That's the ultimate source, matter and laws of matter. The house is resting on the laws of nature and material ingredients. So the absolute truth in Vedic conception is, it's like Krishna says, Brahmanohi Pratishtaham. Krishna is the Pratishta, or the basis and support existentially of Brahman. Brahman exists like this discussion we had on Ramanuja's defeating of Achyuta Preksha's idea of Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma. Everything comes from Brahman. Everything comes from Brahman, and Brahman is resting on Krishna. He's the absolute truth. Brahman is all-pervading, yes. And all things that exist, this thread upon which all things rest, it's resting in Brahman. But it's that Brahman is resting in Krishna, or upon Krishna, Pratishta Aham. That's a nice exercise. What practical meaning does that have in life? It's an interesting, you know, different people have different philosophies and talk about their philosophies and, you know, what's for breakfast? You know, how does this practically affect our lives? And the answer is the view that we have towards Krishna has everything to do with the quality of our life. He is beyond, the verse is saying, he's beyond these modes, creation, maintenance, and destruction, although it's all resting in him. If we want to be beyond the disturbances of material existence, we take our shelter and place our consciousness with the Supreme. Because if we don't have that idea, we're going to have another idea. We're going to have another kind of faith, another quality of life, based upon the modes of nature. It's just the default mode. So then we're being bounced around like a piece of wood in the ocean. Sometimes up, sometimes down, sometimes getting smashed and turned around, and with no shelter but, you know, the tossing and turning of the waves of the ocean, of material existence. And that's a choice. And there's another choice. Recognizing what is the cause of all causes, taking shelter there, getting relief from this disturbing condition of endless material existence. Birth after birth, being tossed around by the movements of the modes of nature. And that is the mission of human life, and that is the absolute truth, and it does make a difference about how we lead our life and what the outcome and consequence of how we lead our life is. In this life and after this life. Saying the same thing, perhaps a little more simply, if we understand that God is great and we're very small, it will naturally follow that we will want to serve Him. If we have a little bit of integrity in us, we'll want to serve Him. It's just natural. In the presence of a great person, one wants to do something for that great person. Just natural. It's not politics. It's just natural. So, when we recognize, the more that we recognize Krishna's actual position, the more it will invoke from us the natural aptitude for serving Him. And when that aptitude for serving Krishna is naturally invoked, the problems of material existence fade and we're drawn into the spiritual realm. That's nice. I want that. I want that for myself, and I want that for as many people as, you know, want to get on board and go there. It's very practical. And so the discussion that's going on in this section of the Bhagavatam about the absolute truth, what's the source of things, what's the purpose of the things that come into being, how is everything maintained, is very practical. It invokes the, if properly understood, it invokes a mood, an unbreakable position of service to the Supreme. That's what the Bhagavatam is meant to do. Bring us to that position. Restore that position. That's the practical effect of the discussion with Narada. Brahma, the father, is informing his son, you should worship Krishna. You can respect me, I'm your father. He's my master. Let us serve him. And perfection will follow. Okay, so we'll end. See if there's any discussion. Yes.
Marsh, not directly related to the class. But earlier we were mentioning that Srila Prabhupada was writing that because of Kali Yuga's presence, the demigods don't manifest themselves in sacrifice.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if the four yugas, are they applicable only to the earthly realm? Or to
no. There's specific scriptural references that indicate Kali Yuga had its influence in the higher realms also. My assumption is that it's proportionately less because the modes of nature are more elevated. That's my assumption. Anything else? You're letting me off easy this morning. Jagadananda?
Try to tie everything together from yesterday's class and today's class. Yesterday's actually afternoon lecture from Mataji's Sushi. So you're mentioning the theme is that Krishna is the maintainer, Lord Vishnu is the maintainer. And then yesterday we were mentioning how as we render devotional service and commit offenses which give rise to anishtha bhakti. And you were mentioning that so the goal, we should understand the goal very clearly. The goal is to want a relationship with Krishna. That is the goal. So is it a proper prayer to while we are making our efforts to pray to Lord Krishna, Vishnu, to maintain our devotional service,
Please keep me always engaged in your devotional service. Maintain my devotional service. Whatever else may happen, please keep me engaged in your devotional service.
The struggles are never ending, it seems, sometimes in devotional service. But
devotional service is eternal. It is never ending. It's coming from the soul, and the soul is eternal. Eternal occupation.
This is just, I'm sure, ignorance on my part, and something from my background. Just growing up, I didn't have a lot of, my parents were Christian, but I didn't have a lot of guided consciousness, I guess. So I kind of developed the attitude towards God thing, where like bad things happen to me and that's your fault, so I don't really want to do anything for you kind of attitude. And so, but now, I mean, gratitude is so important.
Yes.
So, how to see things, well, I know from the scriptural perspective, but just for me practically, I'm trying to better understand how to see things always in a positive light when we see that there are so many things that appear to be negative.
It's challenging if the light is dim. It looks dark. But if the light is on, it's quite clear. Just like just yesterday, our dear Prahlad and Rohit, they had those little things. And it was, you know, it got out of control. And so at a certain point, you know, Prahlad lost his, and he might have thought, and from his perspective, what's wrong? Why would I get punished? My toy was, you know, so he didn't have a big picture. He was just thinking, hey, this is fun. And similarly, Rohit. So we may get, you know, we're going along in life, and then all of a sudden something, there's some restriction. Hey, what's going on? I was having fun. So we don't have the big picture, like little children. But if we were more mature, if the light was on, then we could understand, oh, this is connected to that, and the message is, you know, I have to take responsibility for my actions. Now, I may not know the detail of this action, this reaction, this behavior, this consequence. I may or may not understand, but at least in principle I can understand if there's some restriction, there's a purpose behind that restriction. And in a faithful position, if I, like a child, remains faithful to the mother and father, they'll understand in the course of time. At least, you know, they'll feel protected and safe, whether they understand or they don't understand. And, you know, later on, 10 years from now, the two boys can look back and say, now I understand why that happened. So it may take some maturing to understand things.
Yeah. I guess following up on that, then, if you want to continue. For me, then, I don't feel so much like, okay, so many horrible things have happened to me. I guess it's the Arjuna position. But I look around and I see things.
So much suffering.
And then, but then there's the statement that I'm realizing the importance of, that Srila Prabhupada points out, most of the living entities are not in the suffering position. They are out of that. It's just a small portion in the correctional facility who are choosing not to serve Krishna.
Well, their particular circumstance is a consequence of a whole series of bad choices. Choices, bad choices, bad choices, and now they're in this really constricted situation. Saying, it's not fair, you know, what is, I'm a good person, I didn't, but you know, there's reasons. So the message is that the repentant soul, the humble soul, realizes, I'm in these circumstances because of past choices. I have to take responsibility for those past choices. Let me not go there and make wrong decisions again. Let me go towards the light. So that's a choice that everyone can make. It's a free will choice, and whatever the circumstances. Some persons choose to not make that choice. And by, again, we're in the default mode. If I choose to not make that choice, I'm going to make another choice. The choice is, I'm going to figure my way out of this situation. by hook or by crook. And I implicate myself further in the circumstance. Just by, in principle, not turning attention to the Supreme. Behind every wrong choice, there's plenty of opportunity to justify the wrong choice. I did this to that person because they're like such and such. And I just can't stand when somebody's like such and such, so I did like this. It's justified. And the world goes around on that kind of a basis. Without understanding, you know, the will of God and the bigger picture. And that's the program that we purchased at the software store. The program of suffering. With a big label on it that says enjoy. Without God. I'll take a dozen of those, please.
Is there a specific scriptural reference then about the statement that Srila Prabhupada? I've only heard him make it, I think, in a lecture.
Which?
That it's only a small portion of the citizens in the prison house, kind of thing.
Oh, that's the 3/4, 1/4.
Oh, okay.
That's in this chapter of the Bhagavatam, or the Purusha Sukta. Something else? Yeah.
Like Ekadashi and also the upcoming Nitya and the Trayodashi. So how to observe these special days?
In principle, decrease material and increase spiritual activity. So we fast to whatever degree we observe our Ekadashi fasting, and then we grains and beans, and Nitya Nama Trayodashi, we observe fasting, and increase our hearing. We're trying to do that. And recognize the auspiciousness of the day and of the particular configurations of the day, and increase our enthusiasm in our spiritual practices till we take the fullest possible benefit of the auspicious day. Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Guru Vishnu Prabhupada ki jai.